This session is called The Economics of Information Technology. And before I begin, just to note, and in case anyone hasn't heard this before, that copies of these PowerPoint slides are available on Mises.org and in PDF form. So if you just go to the online version of the schedule, you can see there are links there to most of my talks, and others who have handouts and materials will be linked up there as well. So don't worry about writing down all the quotes and the names and all that. You can get that on the web. Okay. Really what I'm going to talk about is more than information technology narrowly. Really, this is about the economics of innovation and technology more generally. Try to provide some Austrian insight into some current issues associated with technology and innovation. This is kind of a hot area within applied economics. With the tech bubble in the 1990s in particular, a lot of economists began writing on the so-called new economy. You might have heard that term, new economy, that, gosh, aren't things different now that we have a greater emphasis on information technology? Since we have the Internet, how is the world different now? So a lot of research done on the economics of the Internet, the economics of e-commerce, the economics of intellectual property, and so on. And so I want to talk about some of those things today. And this will be kind of a hodgepodge of some different topics, and I'll try to leave some time at the end for us to have some more some open discussion. Okay, just by way of sort of setting the stage, this term new economy really came into vogue in the latter half of the 90s when the stock market was booming and the tech sector was sky high. And you began to see some economists and journalists talk as if, you know, there had been some kind of fundamental structural change in the economy. And some of them even said, well, we need a new kind of economic theory to go along with the new economy, right? That in the, for example, in the old economy, you know, you had the law of increasing costs, but in the new economy where you're producing things like software, you have high fixed costs and low marginal costs. So you have increasing returns to scale everywhere and anywhere, and that radically changes all our beliefs about supply and demand, about, you know, market clearing, about how the capital markets work, and so on. You know, the basic message that I would give to you is, as you can imagine, no, that's a bunch of hooey, right? You know, old economics, old Austrian economics is just as useful in understanding the so-called information economy as it would be in understanding, you know, an economy of steel and iron and railroads. Some of the crazier things that you heard during the 90s, people say, well, there's no, but now we won't have recessions anymore because of the Internet and e-commerce, things, you know, so continual boom. Well, people stopped saying that, you know, around 2000, 2001. People said, well, you know, the old economy was based largely on manufacturing, hard goods. The new economy is based on services rather than manufacturing. Well, okay, but you know, we have seen an increase in the value of the service sector relative to the manufacturing sector, but so what? I mean, economic theory can explain the production of services just as easily as it can explain the production of tangible goods. People say, well, in the old economy, firms were valued according to their tangible assets. You know, General Motors has all these factories producing cars, and that's what investors value. But now it's the intangibles that matter more. It's reputation, brand name capital. You know, companies like Amazon or Google that have very little in the way of tangible assets, but yet they have these huge market capitalizations because people think their brand is valuable. Well, okay, I mean, that's true. Investors do value the expected future returns of companies, and a company that doesn't currently have a lot of earnings or doesn't currently have a lot of tangible capital may still have a very high market value because the reputation of the managers, of the owners, reputation of the brand is high. Again, this is great. There's absolutely no problem with that. People have said, well, there are different forms of competition in the new economy. You know, in the new economy, you compete by giving stuff away for free. You know, you give your software away for free to try to have a big installed user base, and then you make money down the road, blah, blah, blah. We can talk about some of those things. The theoretical questions have been things like, well, the laws of supply and demand don't apply to the production of information, like software or a search engine or, you know, a telephone book, right? That when you're producing information, once you create the product, you can reproduce it at almost a zero cost, right? So doesn't that change the firm's decision, the entrepreneur's decision about how to maximize profits and all that? Or people have said, we have, in the new economy, many markets are characterized by network effects, or what they used to call, and some people still call, network externalities. The value of having a product or service depends on how many other people also have the product or service, and therefore you can't say that the firm that produces the best product will win out in the market. Come back to that point later. Brian Arthur at the Santa Fe Institute is one of the names associated with this network effects literature. And I'm going to try to convince you in the next 45 minutes or so that none of these criticisms are valid, that even though, you know, the modern information economy does have some structural features that are interesting and unusual and worthy of study, that the basic laws of economics apply just as much now as they ever have. Okay? Let me just give you some examples of this information economy, some of these information economy issues. People have pointed out that when the good or service being sold is information rather than a tangible good, market competition often has some peculiarities, like with software. Software companies frequently put out slightly different versions of the same product, you know, the basic version and the advanced version, the simple version and the pro version, 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. And a lot of times, versioning is used as a form of price discrimination. It's a strategic tool that firms can use, right? If you try to segment the market into people with a very elastic demand, people who wouldn't pay very much for the thing, and people with highly inelastic demand who would pay a lot. And the way you charge different prices to the different groups is by offering a basic version that you give away for free, because you wouldn't make much money off those people anyway, and an advanced or professional version that you charge for. You know, like think of Adobe Acrobat, right? You can download the reader for free. You can download readers for, you know, playing, you know, real media files or whatever, the player. But to get the full version of Adobe Acrobat to create PDF files, or the software that lets you create real media files, you have to pay for those. Okay, so it's different classes of consumers. Well, there's absolutely nothing unusual or striking about the fact that companies try to offer different versions of products to segment the market. This has been done for years, long before the information revolution. I mean, think about the market for books, hardbacks versus paperbacks. You know, why are hardbacks so much more expensive than paperbacks? Well, hardbacks are released first at a fairly high price, and then paperbacks are released only sometime later at a lower price. Well, because there are people, they're hardcore fans, you know, the people who line up at midnight to get the next Harry Potter book or whatever. They'll pay almost any price to be first to get the book, so you charge, you know, $30 or $40 for the hardback. And then there are casual readers who are just browsing, and, you know, they might pick up this book and read it if it's cheap. You try to target them with the paperbacks that you sell 6 months or a year down the road. It's a very common and not at all novel business practice. Airlines do it too with ticket pricing. You know, advance fares versus last minute fares. Leisure travelers versus business travelers. A lot of firms producing information goods place an emphasis on retaining customers, because it's presumably easy for customers to switch from one information good provider to another. You have rewards for frequent customers, emphasis on branding, you know, the Amazon brand name, of course, is what gives Amazon its value and so on. People have complained that, well, it's very easy to sort of produce false goods, so-called vaporware, right? You pretend you're going to release a new version of your software to try to prevent people from switching to a rival's brand, but then you never actually go through with it. Okay, whoop-de-doo. The point is, none of these are really new. None of these are particularly new phenomena. And they don't require any major revision to basic economic theory. Let me talk about something I think is a little bit harder to deal with, and that's so-called network effects or network externalities. Network effects played a huge role in the series of antitrust cases, at least the U.S. antitrust cases against Microsoft, and there's ongoing investigations by the European antitrust authorities. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with the basic outlines of the Microsoft case. Microsoft was alleged to have engaged in a whole series of illegal and unethical practices. But the practice I want to focus on in particular, to be more precise, the kind of the general theory or philosophy underlying the case against Microsoft revolves around this idea of network effects. And the case went something like this. It said, Microsoft's huge share in the market for desktop personal computer operating systems, 80 to 90%, depending on how you count, was not due to the fact that it offered a superior product, but due to this nefarious concept of the network externality or the network effect. Let me just explain briefly what that means. Right? If we're talking about markets for, paper cups or podiums or automobiles or whatever, the standard argument has always been, well, consumers will choose the product that offers them the best, that's the best product at the lowest price. And so if one particular company has a large share of the market in paper cups, we would infer that its paper cups are superior or are a better value for the dollar than the paper cups of rivals. Okay, so the best product wins out in the marketplace, best from the point of view of the consumer. Well, in a market with network effects, it is alleged that doesn't happen. So a network effect is present when, as I said before, the value of consuming a good or service is a function of the number of other people who also consume the good or service. Right? So an example for today would be, instant messaging. How many people use instant messaging on their computer? All of the people under the age of 30. Right? How valuable is it to have an IM program on your computer? Well, if nobody else uses instant messaging, well, what are you going to, you're just going to instant message yourself. It's not very valuable. Okay, but the more of your friends who use instant messaging, the more valuable it is for you to use it also. Okay, this argument is not a new argument. It goes back to, imagine being the very first person in the world to have a telephone. What are you going to do with it? Right? So those are examples of markets where the size of the network affects the value of being in the network. Right, and how this applies to software is, in the early days of computing, early days of sort of personal computing in the 1980s, for example, it was fairly difficult to transfer files and programs across platforms, right? So if you used an IBM PC with Microsoft's DOS operating system, it was not easy to transfer files to a Unix machine or an Apple machine. It was not easy to switch among platforms. So the idea is, if you're thinking about buying your first personal computer, and you're thinking, should I buy an IBM PC platform, or should I buy a Macintosh? Should I buy an Apple machine? Well, suppose that there are currently 20 computers out there. There are 10 IBM PCs and 10 Macs, and you're the 21st person. And so, you want to have the kind of computer that most other people have. But so if there's 10 people with a PC and 10 people with a Mac, so maybe you just flip a coin. And let's say it comes up PC. So you say, okay, I'll buy a PC so I can exchange files and share software with the 10 people who already have a PC. Okay, so then the next person, the 22nd person, comes along. Right, but now there's 10 Mac users and 11 PC users. So that next person says, well, gosh, I guess I want to get a PC too, because then I'll have 11 people that I can share stuff with as opposed to 10. And so that person chooses IBM. And of course, the next person and the next person and the next person and the next person. And eventually, almost everybody but those original 10 are using the IBM platform and not the Mac platform. In other words, whoever has an early head start maybe just for some random reason, will end up taking all of the market, sort of a winner-take-all market, right? Where you can't have two different competing standards, each of which has, you know, half the market, because there's an advantage to standardization. So whoever has an early lead will end up swallowing up almost all of the competition, right? So the idea is it's these network effects that have given Microsoft its large market share, not that its products were superior to the products of rivals. Okay, what can we say about this? One of the points that the critics have made is, or extending the critics' argument, they say, in markets where network effects are strong, we can end up sort of being stuck in the stuck on the wrong path, what they call path dependence. A path-dependent process is one in which, you know, sort of where we are today depends on where we were yesterday. Okay, so once we're in a setting where lots of people are using the IBM platform and only a few are using the Mac platform, it's very difficult to switch. Even if a lot of us decided that, oh gosh, the Mac really is better, but you don't want to be the only one who switches, because then you'll be in the minority. You need everyone to switch at the same time, and it's very difficult to coordinate such a switch. Therefore, we can end up being stuck going down the wrong path, and we can't get out of it. Even if we want to, we can't get out of it. Other examples of markets in which network effects and path dependence are said to have caused problems. The most famous such market is the most famous such example is that of the QWERTY keyboard. You know, the arrangement of keys on a typewriter, standard QWERTY arrangement. I mean, you may have wondered why are they laid out like that? I mean, why not A B C D E F G? Where does QWERTY come from? Well, an economist at Stanford University named Paul David published an article in 1985 in the American Economic Review on the economics of QWERTY, where he told the following story. He said, well, QWERTY, it turns out, is not a very efficient, it's not an ergonomically efficient layout. In fact, you can type faster using some alternative layouts. There's one you may have heard of called the Dvorak layout that puts the keys in a slightly different position, and allegedly you can type faster and with fewer errors using the Dvorak system. Well, why don't we use Dvorak then? Well, according to Paul David, in the early days of typing, early 20th century, late 19th century, when typewriters were first invented, there were a whole series of different layouts that were tried and experimented with. They would have typing contests where different vendors would go from town to town and they'd have a contest to see who could type the fastest. And according to David, there was one particular typist who happened to use QWERTY for no particular reason, just randomly. And that person was good and won some typing contests, and people thought mistakenly, well, maybe QWERTY is a good layout to use. Other people started using QWERTY. And you can see the network effect here, right? If you're trained to type on a QWERTY keyboard, you can't easily switch to a Dvorak keyboard. It'd take you a while to learn it. Right, so if you're learning how to type, it's in your interest to learn on the keyboard layout that most other people use. Right, so you can use any typewriter, you can go to somebody else's house and use their typewriter, whatever. Right, so in David's story, QWERTY had a little bit of head start over rival layouts, and because of the network effect, all new typists started to train themselves, more and more started to train themselves on QWERTY, and eventually everybody was using QWERTY, and it became the de facto standard, even though it's less efficient than some alternative. Right, so David said he claimed to have identified a new source of market failure. It's an example where the market fails to choose the best product because of network effects and path dependence. Other examples, one that most of you are too young to remember, but in the early days of video cassette machines, there were competing standards for the tapes. There was the VHS standard, is the one that we use now for most tapes. And there was also one produced by Sony called Betamax. I don't know if anybody remembers having seen a Betamax machine. The beta tapes were smaller, almost like a VHS-C or a Super 8 tape today. The machines were more expensive. The picture quality was supposedly better. And there was a rivalry between these two formats, the VHS format and the Betamax format. And I can remember as a kid going to the video store and, you know, every cassette, there'd be two different sizes. You know, you'd pick what movie you wanted and then you'd get either the VHS cassette or the beta cassette depending on which kind of recorder you had at home, which kind of machine you had. Right now, it's obvious that there are advantages to having standardization here rather than having two competing formats. Well, allegedly, VHS, because of some arbitrary reasons, you know, it had a few more titles than beta because of deals that the manufacturers had made with movie studios or whatever, that, you know, people, more VHS got a little bit of a head start over beta, and because of the network effect, all of a sudden everybody's using VHS, even though it's the inferior technology to beta, which had a clearer picture, higher resolution picture, and a more compact cassette.
Wasn't it the case that VHS licensed their technology and Sony just trying to be the sole manager?
Right, yeah, that's also part of the story. I'm going to come back to this example in just a second. Just a clarification question?
Yeah, wasn't it also the case that for a while there, the beta was clearly predominant in terms of the availability of, you know, tapes? I mean, it clearly was the more prevalent format.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. That may be right. But there was some switching point before the market became really mature in which VHS tended to become the dominant technology. Right? Well, I'm going to come back to this in just a second. You know, and the same applies to MS-DOS and the Mac. Again, if any of you are old enough to remember, or if you ever tried, you know, before Windows, if you had an IBM PC, you had to type at the DOS prompt, you know, DIR/P, whatever, you know, instead of point and click with a mouse. And people said, well, gosh, the point-and-click mouse technology is a lot better. The Mac is a far more advanced operating system than PC, than the old DOS program. Why didn't everybody switch to the Mac? Well, allegedly because, you know, you want to maintain compatibility with everybody else, and if more people have a PC, then you're not going to switch. And thus, MS-DOS, Microsoft came to be the dominant manufacturer because of this network effect. Okay, what's wrong with this argument? Well, there's several things wrong with it, I think. Right, the first is, think about the knowledge problem or our lack of perfect knowledge about the future. Right, it's very easy for someone today with 20/20 hindsight to say, well, you know, Dvorak is really better than QWERTY, we know now. We know now that beta is really better than VHS. The market should have chosen Dvorak, or the market should have chosen beta. Gee, the market screwed up. Isn't that awful? Well, I mean, at the time, market participants were choosing the product or the technology that they thought best satisfied their ends. The fact that even if market participants later regret the choices that they make, that by itself does not imply any kind of market failure. It just means we don't have perfect knowledge of the future, and we sometimes experience ex post regret. So that would not be a sufficient claim that we ought to have some alternative, you know, that we ought to let the government choose the technologies. Switching costs, right? Some have made the point that, look, suppose it's true that we're struck with the wrong technology. We went down the wrong path. Well, if the cost of switching to another technology is high, and if we take that cost into account, then the net benefits of switching are negative. So in that sense, we're doing the best we can. Right? We can't improve on the status quo because it's too costly to switch, so what's the problem? Okay. But I think there are better arguments that can be made. One pertains to marginal analysis. I think that some of the critics make the mistake of confusing marginals and totals. In other words, they say, well, you know, suppose I want to compete with Microsoft. You know, so I'm going to produce the Klein OS. Kleindos or something instead of Windows, and I'm going to take over from Microsoft. The critics say, well, that would be impossible, right? Because, you know, nobody's going to buy my operating system unless there exist applications to run on it. You know, unless you can get a word processor and a spreadsheet program that runs on the Klein OS, nobody's going to buy the Klein OS, right? But what applications manufacturer would manufacture applications that run on the Klein OS if nobody has the Klein OS? So it's kind of a, you know, chicken and egg. How can I ever overcome that barrier? They call it the applications barrier to entry. Right? Well, I think what's wrong with that argument is, you know, I can compete with Microsoft without producing a product that is a full-blown head-to-head competitor. In other words, I don't have to produce a full-fledged operating system that does everything that Windows does. I can produce a small, maybe a niche product that is targeted at a few users who have highly specialized needs, and I can earn enough money to make that viable. Right? I mean, look at the Linux platform. Right? Linux didn't start out being a full-fledged alternative to Windows, although in a sense it almost is now. Right? But, you know, by targeting certain, you know, high-tech users and people who have applications that are designed for Unix, Linux manufacturers have made just enough money to make it feasible to continue producing their product. You know, look at Sun Computing. Sun Computers makes, you know, Unix workstations, the Sun Spark stations. You know, they don't have a huge share of the market, but they have a viable share. And once you can start small and presumably add customers a few at a time, and maybe eventually the client OS would be big enough to be a competitor with Microsoft. The point is, I don't have to be able to compete with Microsoft head-to-head on the first day. I can start small, and on the margin, I can add customers as I add features, as I add new applications, and so on. But going to some even stronger arguments, the political process. Somebody could say, gee, yeah, I agree. There is path dependence. The market can choose the inefficient technology. But what's the alternative? Right? You know, it's like my grandmother used to say, dying's not so bad once you consider the alternative. Right? Or getting old's not so bad once you consider the alternative. Right? I mean, what are we going to have instead of the market choosing technologies and standards? Are we going to have a government agency? Are we going to ask politicians and bureaucrats to tell us whether to use VHS or beta? Politicians are going to decide whether to use QWERTY or Dvorak or the PC or the Mac. I mean, we can imagine all of the problems that would be associated with that, right? And I would think, if anything, if path dependence is a problem anywhere, it would be in the political process. Right? I mean, who's exchanged the most favors for votes and campaign contributions in the past is going to get their technology chosen and so on. So that would hardly be an improvement, even if we thought the critics were right. But for some of the reasons that we've discussed, I don't think we should even concede the critics' initial point, right? That markets do choose the wrong technologies. And if we look at the historical record and we study these examples in more detail, it turns out that all of the critics' examples don't wash. Okay, they're all deeply flawed. And the scholars who have done the most work on this are two economists named Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. They've written a series of papers sort of debunking the QWERTY myth. Their first paper in this series, published I think in 1990, was called The Fable of the Keys, which is a pun on a famous article, a story called The Fable of the Bees by Bernard Mandeville. But in The Fable of the Keys, they revisit the historical record on typing and find that the story that Paul David told is actually completely wrong. That what happened in the early days of typing, they look at some ergonomic data, ergonomic tests that show, first of all, that it really isn't true that Dvorak is better than QWERTY. Almost any keyboard layout is as good as any other layout once you learn it, right? That just repetition is what makes for skilled typing. So it really doesn't matter which keyboard layout you use. What happened in the early days of typing was, it's not that there was just one contest where some QWERTY typist won. In fact, there were lots of contests held all over the country, and there were lots of different layouts that won. QWERTY won some, Dvorak won some, or actually not Dvorak, but other alternative layouts won some. And, if, you know, QWERTY was just as good as any other layout that was available at the time, and continues to be just as good now. In fact, Paul David's article reporting the superiority of the Dvorak keyboard, if you trace the footnotes, he based his claims on a U.S. Navy study that had claimed the superiority of Dvorak. And Liebowitz and Margolis uncovered that the U.S. Navy study had been conducted by Mr. Dvorak himself, the guy who invented that keyboard. So, in fact, there's no evidence that QWERTY is worse than any other layout. Some other economists, Deirdre McCloskey, for example, has pointed out that, remember, in the early days of typing, individuals didn't typically own typewriters. It was, you know, big companies who had large typing pools of secretaries, you know, hundreds of secretaries who would type and they would shift around. McCloskey points out that if, in fact, there really were savings from, if, you know, if you could really type faster and with fewer errors from switching to Dvorak, but no such switch is feasible because you'd have to get a large group of people to switch at the same time because of the network effect. McCloskey points out, well, why wouldn't a large company that controls its own typing pool switch? Right? If there are really gains from Dvorak and you yourself employ, you know, 300 typists, well, why not give them a new layout and, you know, maybe it takes a week to retrain them, but eventually they're on the faster layout and they're reaping huge savings. In other words, you see the point, you internalize the externality, the sense that there's no network externality within a typing pool because the, you know, the owner of the company can decide what keyboard everybody will use. And the owner of the company gets to keep the benefits from switching to the more efficient keyboard. So the fact that we don't know of any company that ever switched its typist from QWERTY to something else indicates that there probably aren't any gains from switching. Okay, even if the externality could be internalized. So the QWERTY story really doesn't hold water. The VHS story doesn't hold water either, because part of the problem is there's a confusion in much of the critical literature on technology standards between technological superiority and economic superiority. Okay, so a lot of the critics who say, well, VHS is really inferior to Beta, and IBM's operating system is really inferior to the Mac. They mean superior or inferior in a technological sense, you know, in the geek sense of, you know, a more elegant technology, a more sophisticated technology. Well, remember, what we claim in the free market is not that the most technologically advanced product always wins out on the market, but that the product that is perceived to be most valuable to consumers wins out in the market, right? So yes, the Beta tapes were smaller and the picture quality was higher, but the Beta machines were also a lot more expensive than the VHS machines, and the Beta tapes could not record for as long. The Beta tape could only record for 30 minutes and the VHS tapes could record for 2 hours. Right now we have, you know, an extended mode that you can record for 6 hours or whatever. So consumers were weighing, you know, on the one hand, a sharper, clearer picture and a smaller tape that was more expensive and had a lower recording time, you know, than a bigger, bulkier tape that where the picture quality wasn't quite as high, but you could record longer and it was cheaper. And consumers decided they preferred the latter rather than the former, right? And who are we to say, you know, some engineer can come along and say, well, Beta's better. Okay, fine, but not better to consumers. What matters on the market is being able to satisfy consumer wants, not, you know, impressing some engineer. Okay, I mean, the same is true with the MS-DOS versus, you know, Mac, for example. I mean, I remember when the first Macs came out in 1984, and actually 1985, I was a college student. And I remember somebody who lived in my hall had one of the first Macs. And so, of course, we all went to look at it. And, ooh, you know, this is cool. And, you know, what the mouse, what's that? What do you do with that? But it turned out that the early Macs were not only much more expensive than IBM PCs, but they were also sort of toys. And they weren't very good for, they weren't very useful for the typical day-to-day tasks that people were performing back then. Right? I mean, most people used their computers then for, you know, typing letters and, you know, word processing, for spreadsheets, you know, database applications. And the Mac was incredibly slow. It just, you know, the command line operating system and the old, you know, WordStar and Lotus 1-2-3 and DBase and these ancient applications, they were great. They were fast, they were efficient, they were inexpensive. They worked much better for the needs that people actually had relative to the Macintosh. So how can we say the market made the wrong choice? Right? The market made the choice that was consumers picked the product that actually did satisfy their needs better than the alternative products. The market didn't fail. The market made the correct choice. Okay? Or we have no reason to claim that the market failed. And, you know, Leibowitz has also pointed out that People say, well, why didn't the market choose the graphical graphical user interface and point and click? Well, the market did later. It's just we call it Windows, not, you know, Macintosh. To the extent that people did value that alternative interface, and as hardware improved to the point where it could keep up with the software, people have switched to a GUI type, a Macintosh type of system. Okay, so all of the real-world examples of path dependence turn out to be very seriously flawed, so I don't think it's something that we should be concerned about. Okay, let me make a couple of comments about the Internet and about intellectual property, and then hold it open for some questions. The Internet is an extremely interesting case. Some economists have pointed out that, you know, in some sense the Internet represents sort of a great example of market order, or the Internet is like a spontaneous order because nobody controls it. Individuals and, you know, can sort of attach to it, and different standards and technologies emerge in a decentralized, invisible hand kind of a way. To some degree, I share that enthusiasm, but also with some reservations, more reservations than most of my free market colleagues have, because I think it's important to remember that the Internet emerged not as a commercial for-profit technology, right, but as the result of a Defense Department project, right? The Internet we use today is the successor to what was called the ARPANET, or DARPANET, created by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, in the 1960s. It was the result of a Defense Department study to try to figure out how different military facilities could communicate in the event of a nuclear war, right? So the idea was, with conventional, what you might call kind of trunk line, point-to-point technology, you know, if there's a base over here in California, and there's a base over here in Washington, and you know, there's a wire connecting those bases, and they communicate over that wire. Well, what if the Russians, you know, drop a bomb right here and destroy, you know, the entire Midwest? You know, that line is severed, so how are these guys going to communicate? And technology engineers at ARPA and with the RAND Corporation, to whom a lot of the work had been subcontracted, came up with this idea of a decentralized, what they call a packet switching network, where, you know, when the California base sends a message to the Washington base, the message, the electronic message, is broken up into little pieces called packets. And the packets are then routed independently to their destination. So rather than have just a line going from this city to this city, and then a line going from this city to this city, you have more like a web, right, with lots of little strokes, little lines going from this place to this place. So a packet of information doesn't go straight on the express route to DC. Instead, it goes here and here and here, and it wiggles around from one node to the next until eventually it gets to its destination. So the idea was to create a network without a central node that could be taken out, right? So if any one part of the network were destroyed, packets could be rerouted around the destroyed part and then would be reassembled at their destination. Okay? That's the underlying technology on which the Internet still operates, right? I mean, some of you who, the geeks among you know about packets and the speed at which packets are received and sent over the Internet and stuff. But that's the whole idea. It was explicitly designed to facilitate a certain kind of communication, okay? Now, you know, is path dependence and the associated communications protocols, what's called TCP/IP, Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol. That's the information that's encoded on the header of every packet, right? So each little packet, if I have an email message that's broken up into five packets, each packet has a little header that says where it came from and where it's going and where it fits in the sequence, so it can be reassembled when all the packets get to their destination. Of course, all that happens in just a matter of seconds in most cases. This particular technology turns out to be very useful for some applications, but not for others. See, of course, what happened is, you know, the Defense Department created this network and then began to allow some scientific researchers at major universities to attach their machines to the network. So there was a declassified part of the ARPA network that eventually was taken over by the National Science Foundation, and different universities were able to attach to this network. Then eventually commercial providers, you might remember the old dial-up providers like Prodigy and CompuServe and the old AOL, were eventually able to hook their networks up to this new network, which became called the Internet, and was eventually fully declassified. Now the Defense Department has its own super, you know, ultra-secret secure network. But the Internet that we have now is the outgrowth of the ARPANET and still relies on the same basic packet switching technology. So the point is, well, I mean, this seems to be, this, if anything, is an example of path dependence, right? The technology that we use today is a function of the technology that the Defense Department came up with in the 60s. You know, well, who cares? Why does that matter? Well, there are some reasons why it may be a cause of concern. The packet switching technology works very well for applications that do not require real-time connectivity. You know, text messaging or sending emails or transferring files. You know, if there's a few seconds delay between when one packet gets there and another packet gets there, it's no big deal when you're receiving an email message. But for, you know, real-time video, even small delays in transmission speed can have an effect. I mean, I'm sure all of you have tried to listen to, you know, streaming audio or video on your computer, and it's herky-jerky or it breaks up and there's all these buffering delays and it's not as smooth as it could be. You know, you can imagine if you were, you know, we talk about using the Internet for really high-valued purposes like, you know, allowing a surgeon in one city to participate in surgery that's going on in another city. You know, you need the information sent back and forth really fast. Small glitches in transmission could really affect, you know, it could be a matter of life and death. Well, part of the reason that we have these glitches, if you think about it, is that the packet switching technology is also very egalitarian. And by that I mean, you know, what happens is all the packets are broken up and then they go out into the network, and whenever you get to a particular node, you know, the packets sort of wait in line and then they are sent through the node in order. But there's no way to prioritize the order other than first come, first served. In other words, there's no sort of equivalent of FedEx, you know, for a packet. Where suppose that I'm, you know, I'm a surgeon and I really want my packets to get through faster than somebody else's packets. You know, so I'm sharing the same nodes and the same lines with, you know, some teenagers who are sending IMs back and forth. You know, dude, cool, what about this? You know, there ought to be a way for me to, you know, attach a dollar value or a priority value to my packets and get them through first and make the teenagers wait. But current TCP/IP technology does not allow that. You can't pay to get through faster. So naturally, a lot of economists have studied this and said, well, this leads to the typical kind of overuse, so-called tragedy of the commons problem, right? That because sending the packets is effectively costless, people tend to send, the resource is not allocated efficiently because it's underpriced, just like any sort of common property resource. You know, so my point is, not to claim that the Internet isn't great, or not to say, gee, I wish we didn't have the Internet. Not at all. But my point is, I think we need to be careful when we describe the Internet as, you know, the shining example of what the free market can do. That, well, there's a heck of a lot of intervention that went into its creation. And the truth is, we really don't know what kind of a communications network we would have today if the government had never been involved. Right? You know, maybe it would be like the internal corporate networks that large firms had long before the Internet. Maybe it would be like CompuServe or Prodigy. Maybe it would operate under a different kind of technology other than TCP/IP. Maybe it would be better. Maybe it wouldn't be. The point is, who knows? Right? In admiring the current Internet, we have to be careful not to commit Hazlitt's broken window fallacy. Right? You remember the broken window fallacy from Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, taken from Bastiat. Right? That, you know, we see the new pane of glass and we think, oh, isn't this wonderful? And we see the money that the glazier has, and we see the money that the people he bought stuff from has. But, you know, what we don't see is, you know, I forget the example, the tailor who would have, you know, the shopkeeper would have bought a new suit if he didn't have to buy the pane of glass. And so we don't see the value that was never created because the shopkeeper had to buy the new glass. Right? Well, same thing here, right? We see the internet as it currently exists. What we don't see is the kind of internet we might have had if all of those dollars hadn't been taken from the private sector and given to the Defense Department. Right? And of course, I hardly need to add to this audience that we can imagine that the researchers spending those tax dollars in the 1960s probably didn't spend them in the most judicious fashion, right? They probably wasted a lot of money, and they didn't have bottom line pressures. You know, it's funny, some internet enthusiasts think that's a good thing. Now, there are a lot of internet enthusiasts who are very anti-market, anti-capitalist. Let me show you a quotation from a document that still floats around called the Netbook, almost like a public open source kind of history of the internet. And there's a quotation that always struck me from this Netbook. It says, "The current global computer network has been developed by scientists and researchers and users who were free of market forces. Because of the government oversight and subsidy of network development, these network pioneers were not under the time pressures or bottom line restraints that dominate commercial ventures. Therefore, they could contribute the time and labor needed to make sure the problems were solved." Right? In other words, the researchers and scientists who developed the internet were not under the constraint that they had to produce something that anybody actually wanted. Okay? They didn't have to satisfy consumer demands because they were spending government money. So again, I'm not criticizing them, criticizing their engineering skill, but it's important to point out that they were, precisely because they were not under any pressures to produce goods and services desired by consumers, we have no reason to be confident that the output is of the type that consumers would have preferred. Okay, so I think that's something important to keep in mind. Let me make a couple of remarks about intellectual property, because it's on the same theme and it's something important that has come up quite a lot. It certainly is important for in the digital world, right, with digital media and the Napster case, and I don't know if any of you have, you know, spent time in prison for downloading songs or videos, but you know, sort of the basic theoretical question here is, you know, what does it mean to own property? Right? Let's assume that we all agree that private property is legitimate and private property should be protected. There still remains the question of what things are legitimately property. You know, with tangible property, it's pretty easy. If, you know, I have a pen and this is my pen, and if, you know, somebody grabs my pen and takes it, well, they've stolen my property and they've violated my rights. Okay, clear-cut case. But, you know, what if I write a song and I sing the song and Alan here makes a recording of my song and then he sells a copy of the song to Wendy? Has he violated my property rights? Do I have ownership of the song that he possesses on his tape recorder or on his iPod or whatever? You can see that's a bit more of an ambiguous case. It's a much more difficult case. Rothbard's view of intellectual property, it's in Power and Market and other places as well, was Rothbard thought that some forms of intellectual property were legitimate but some were not. Or I should say, some kinds of intellectual property protection were legitimate and some were not. He thought that patents, for example, were not legitimate in a free society. Right? Because if you think about what a patent does, right? A patent prevents somebody else from making a copy of your thing. Right? So, you know, if I have a patent on a pen that uses, ink balls or whatever, no one else can come along and make a pen that also uses ink balls. And Rothbard said, well, but wait a minute. I mean, why, if pen is made by BIC, right? If BIC happens to be the first one to file with the government for ownership of the technology that uses a ballpoint pen, if somebody else comes along and manufactures a pen that's very similar, in what way have they violated the rights of BIC? Okay, they haven't broken into BIC's, you know, warehouse and stolen their machines or stolen their blueprints, because that would be theft, right? But assume that some other company independently comes up with the same idea to use a little ball and the thing of ink. Why? Whose rights are they violating by putting their idea into practice? So you can't own the idea of how a particular technology works, according to Rothbard. Now, of course, he says that you could have contractual restrictions that would in fact protect trade secrets, right? I mean, the bit company could have in the contract, whenever I buy a pen, I have to sign something, maybe using the pen, right, indicating that I promise not to open it up and reverse engineer it and try to make a pen that's similar, right? So a bit customer could be contractually bound from producing another pen, but that still wouldn't restrict, you know, somebody who's not a customer, who's never had any relation with BIC, who just independently comes up with the same idea. Rothbard thought it was unjust to prevent someone from using his own idea just because someone else happened to think of the same idea first. Rothbard did think that copyrights were legitimate, however. He thought that in a free society there would be legal protection for works of art and literature and so on. I mean, in case you don't know, the distinction between patent and copyright is patent protects the idea itself, whereas copyright protects the expression of the idea. Right? So if I write a novel, you know, about, you know, with some particular plot line, and I have a copyright on that novel, my copyright does not protect the basic plot line. It protects the specific words and phrases that I use. So someone else can write a similar novel with a similar plot in a similar setting, but as long as they don't actually copy my text, they haven't violated my copyright. Whereas a patent protects the underlying idea itself. Okay, and interestingly and curiously, most software is patented, is copyrighted, not patented, which some people think is odd, because what if anything, you would want to protect the underlying technology, not the specific keystrokes that you use to do this or that, which is more what the copyright protects. But anyway, Stefan Kinsella has written several articles critiquing Rothbard and arguing that even copyrights should not be legitimate in a free society, that one cannot have property rights in the expression of an idea and a thought in a set of words, partly because they're not scarce, and goods that are not scarce do not constitute property worthy of protection. But, you know, if you think about it, here, let me give you an illustration that I think sort of shows you how complex this issue is. Let's take one of these digital media cases, right? So suppose I go onto the web, you know, there's some, I'm an artist, let's say, and I cut a CD, and then somebody else rips the CD onto their hard drive, and then they, you know, upload the file or they transfer the file to somebody else. So somebody else now has a copy of my song on his computer. Okay. Well, what do we mean? What does the person actually have in his possession? Well, you know, if say he's got it on a CD. What is a CD? Well, you guys know what a CD is, right? It's a plastic disc with, if you looked at it under a microscope, you'd see it has an uneven surface, little bumps. Right, you know, the information in the song is encoded into binary language, ones and zeros. And then, you know, the bumps correspond to ones and the little valleys correspond to zeros or whatever. So when the laser reads the disc, it's reading all these ones and zeros in a certain sequence that is then retranslated into my song. Okay? So let's say I own the song. Okay, so I own the information that constitutes the song. You might say, I own the string of ones and zeros that encodes or embodies my song. But what does the guy over here who has an illegal copy of my song have? Well, he has a piece of plastic that he owns, right? He plays it in a CD drive that he owns. He owns the laser. He owns all the tangible property, right? In what sense can we say that he has violated my property rights by having a copy of my song that I don't want him to have? If I can own the song, and if his downloading and reproducing the song is a violation of my rights, then in a sense, we're saying I can control his use of the tangible property. It's not quite clear what rights of mine he has violated, right? Even if we say I own the idea, do I own the physical medium in which the idea is encoded? That's really hard. That opens up a huge can of worms. Now, it's not a good response to say, as many musicians have, and as some utilitarian economists have, have said, well, you know, if we didn't, if we allowed people to download songs, if we didn't, you know, crack down on Napster and peer-to-peer file sharing and all that, then artists wouldn't have a sufficient incentive to produce music. Right? If we didn't have patents and copyrights, people wouldn't have enough of an incentive to invent things. Well, that's a highly flawed utilitarian kind of argument. Right? I mean, who knows what the optimal rate of invention is? I mean, suppose the government were to pass a law that every time I write a journal article, you know, I get $1 million of tax money. Right? And somebody comes along and says, well, that doesn't seem fair for Klein to get all these taxpayer subsidies. And I say, wait a minute. If he didn't give me the $1 million, I wouldn't have enough incentive to write, you know, my brilliant path-breaking articles. And so they would say, well, who, you know, how do we know that Klein's articles are even worth having? Right? So, yeah, of course. I mean, if you take away the patents, firms will do less R&D. But does that mean the amount of R&D they're doing with the patent system is optimal? How do we know they're currently doing the right amount of R&D? Maybe we have too much music, right? Maybe. This is not too far-fetched. You know, lots of the music that we have is total crap. And if we didn't have, you know, if people were free to download music and copy it any way they wanted, maybe we'd have less music but better music. Maybe musicians would have alternative ways to earn income off their music and so on. Right, so in other words, that in itself is not a very strong, the utilitarian argument is not a very strong one, because it assumes that we can sort of know what the optimal amount of music or innovation is, and that we can design a legal protection scheme that gives us that optimal amount. Well, we don't know what that optimal amount is. The optimal amount in any meaningful sense of optimal is whatever the market decides. Right, so you need some kind of theory of property that would justify telling the guy that he can't use his computer and his hard drive or his CD and his optical drive the way he wants, that he's violating my rights somehow. And I don't think a very compelling theory like that has yet been offered. Okay, so just to summarize, it's true that the information economy has some interesting features to it, but it's no big deal, right? The standard theories, the standard arguments still apply just as well as they always did. So I think these things are interesting and fun to study, and I study them myself, but they don't challenge any of my deeply held beliefs about how the economy works. Okay, let me stop for some questions. I think you were first, and then here.
I don't see how you can say that if we didn't have copyright, we might have less crappy music. Because, I mean, if it's crappy, nobody's going to buy it now. Why would people be less likely to buy it? Protection does not create demand.
Yeah, no, I was being somewhat flippant in the sense that I wasn't claiming that the ratio of good to bad music is specifically a function of the legal protection regime. I mean, it might be, but I haven't offered an argument for that. All I meant was it's possible that the amount of music we currently have is more than the optimal amount. And so if we had less protection, yeah, we'd have less music, but you have to show that that's a social loss somehow. That society is worse off having less music when music is unprotected. So you can't just simply saying that if we didn't have legal protection, fewer recording artists would cut songs is not an argument for having legal protection. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know about, you know, volume, but I mean the very nature of the copyright system would encourage more high quality to come into existence than would otherwise. I mean, that's why it exists.
I don't see that at all. Yeah, I mean your ability to copyright your work doesn't have anything to do with any measure of quality. I mean, I can copyright anything.
This works with patents better than it does with copyright. But if I'm going to spend, you know, a year or 2 years writing this wonderful work, and I put it out on the market under my name, and the next day 1,000 copies come under, you know, because some people realize mm-hmm. it's great, and then I make money from selling one copy. Great. Well, then I just wasted 2 years of my life.
But that's the labor theory of value. I mean, who knows that the fact that you put 2 years into it makes it good music?
No, that's not the point. I'm stipulating it's good. Okay.
Right. But you're begging the question. I'm saying all we can say on the market is, you know, the music will be, consumers will purchase the music that they value the most highly, right? So we don't know whether how the quality of music is affected by the form of protection that's offered. Let's move on to another question. We'll pick up yours later. I think you were next.
Yeah, I just wanted to take it away from music and into, say, pharmaceuticals. Because it seems to me that even if we don't know the optimal output of good medicine, we know it's not zero, and we know significantly above zero. And I think a case can be made that if, you know, Pfizer can't reap a profit off 30 years of R&D in a particular life-saving drug, then they're just not going to do it.
So would you say 30 is the optimal patent length? Why not 40?
Well, I'm not pointing to that. I don't know if it's 30 or 40. I know it's not zero. And so this argument you're making says that zero is legitimate.
Right, but I don't know how you know that it's zero. How do you know that it's not zero? You know that it's, you don't know whether it's 30 or 40. You know that it's not zero.
I'll understand. I understand that Pfizer is not going to do it. They're not going to do it.
Yeah. Okay, well, not everyone has the same subjective understanding. But the point is, first of all, you're assuming that the only incentive a pharmaceutical company has to produce drugs is patent protection, right? You're overlooking other... There are other forms of protecting one's intellectual property, trade secrets, contractual restrictions, right? I can produce a product and not sell it to anyone without a legal restriction on their ability to reproduce it. Okay, there are plenty of ways to protect one's intellectual property aside from getting a patent. Because, I mean, think about it. If you study the patents, anyone who has studied the patent system closely knows that the patent system is a huge mess. Okay, not just the length of protection issue, but we know that many things are, not to pick on you, but, you know, with a little bit of understanding, most people understand that, you know, at least half the things that are patented have absolutely no value whatsoever, and a lot of extremely valuable products and technologies are never patented, because patent protection is not always the best way to protect one's intellectual property. There are all kinds of abuses in the patent system and so on. So even if you believe, as I do, that yes, it's great for inventors to be able to protect their inventions in some fashion, it doesn't follow that making it illegal for someone to produce a similar product is the right way to do that.
What is the right way?
Okay. Well, I mean, we're already over our time, but there actually are. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole series of mechanisms. Look at open source software, for example. There are plenty of incentives to participate in open source projects, even though the code is freely available. Why is that? Well, the people who write the code enhance their personal reputation on the market. They earn more money. They have higher employment opportunities. That gives them an incentive to participate. There are, again, contractual protections such as the ones that we mentioned. Just one more question, then we really need to break. I think you were next.
Can we erase the blackboard and kind of start over from the beginning of? So the objective through time was to create a sphere of independence for an individual. He owns himself, he can own the real estate, therefore he can take the natural resources of that real estate and create product. And we have a free enterprise system. So that individual gets up in the morning and says, I've got to look around and see what I can provide my fellow human beings in order to get what I need. So you have two people. They have the right for what they're producing. One's producing shoes, making shoes. The other one is producing music to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
If you make a pair of shoes, you set them aside there, and someone comes in and steals them, that's illegal. If you make some music, the purpose of which is to make a living, it's your product. It's just as much a product as those shoes are, and one of and if you cannot do that, there's no motivation for you to do it. There's no means for you to make a living.
But again, that begs the question of what can legitimately be owned. I mean, look, I can stand on a street corner and I can shout out a bunch of words, and I say, "Well, I do that for a living." Does that mean that someone who hears my words and then repeats them to someone else has stolen my shoes?
For determining what's the product, I don't think it's that difficult.
Okay, well,
you're creating a complication that's not there. If you're in the business of a profession to create a software, for example, that is your product.
But so is it your view that are there any restrictions on copyright and patent in your view?
This is where rational people come together. Nothing is perfect. But you have to begin with the concept that that is your problem.
Okay.
And therefore, you put some restrictions on it. You make it perfect.
Okay.
You know, we're not God.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, but I'll get the last word. I mean... I guess we differ in the sense that you think I'm making something simple more complex than it needs to be, and I think you're vastly oversimplifying a very complex issue.
When you get into the details, I understand where you're coming from.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming.